Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
All right, I'm Serge.
I'm Chris.
And this is Libre Lounge, the podcast about user freedom. And what we thought we would do this time is talk a little bit about free culture and remix culture and just have a casual conversation about all this good stuff.
Yep. So probably most people who listen to this podcast are familiar with free software, the very free as in freedom definition of free software. And so that's probably already familiar territory. It's interesting that the moment we mention free culture, it actually immediately becomes somewhat ambiguous because, in some senses, there are kind of two different definitions of free culture, right? There's like what Lawrence Lessig put in his book of free culture, and then there's kind of a more strict definition in the definition of free cultural works that got published.
Yeah. So you want to talk about the Lessig definition? Cause I'm not as familiar with that.
Well, okay. So it's not really a Lessig definition. It's kind of more, if you read the book Free Culture, the book, and it kind of reflects on how Creative Commons has some what we would consider non-free licenses amongst its set. The book kind of, what it's advocating is, my friend Ashish Loria described it as, instead of being about this strict set of principles, it's about a culture that lives on, right? So this is actually very similar to remix culture in some ways, that it's more concerned about the ability to keep copying and remixing things and stuff like that without necessarily having this kind of core set of principles and kind of the hardcore way that appeared in what was a later write-up called The Definition of Free Cultural Works, which pretty much just mirrors the free software definition as Stallman wrote it.
So let's talk about this in a historical time frame way and then in a definition way. So when we talk about free software, what we're really talking about, and we talked about this in episode 3, is the history of free software was that in the very beginning, copywriting your work and keeping the source code proprietary just wasn't a thing. It was freely shared. And people in we'll call the formal free culture movement, talk about how art was very similar for a very long time. Most works of art aren't signed. It was the work that was important over the maker of that work. The work sort of spoke for itself. And many artists in the past were sponsored. They had patrons that would pay for their time, and they would work on commission. But a lot of their work, they just did through, again, their patrons rather than for commercial distribution. And this idea of copyright didn't really exist until the last few hundred years. And I'll link to Carl Fogel's talk about the history of copyright in the show notes, because he gets very deep into this. And then the way this gets extended to today is, a copyright in the last approximately 100 years, starting in the United States, but now worldwide, has become longer. It has become more strict than it ever has in the past. And I might have my numbers wrong, but in the U.S. early on, it was you had a 7-year copyright against works that were only of a specific type. So they had to be maps and other kind of functional, what we'll call functional works, and we'll define that later. And that was only for 7 years. And that was at a time when distribution really was very limited. And now it's, I want to say 100, I think it's 120 years past the author's death. So, and that's retroactive, which means that, you know, at one time it was only 50 years, at one time it was 100 years, and then works that would have been in the public domain get extended. So again, we'll link to this because I think this is an important background into the topic. And nowadays, what we have are two we'll say one formal group, which we'll call the free culture community, and they define themselves as a free culture community. And then what I'll call either the creative, I think it's three. So we'll call the Creative Commons community. And I'll say that that's separate from the Creative Commons organization. And then the Remix community. And I know Chris, who worked for Creative Commons, might disagree with me on this. So I'm making these distinctions. But let me give my definitions, and then I'd love to hear how you differentiate. So I'd say the free culture community has a strict definition of what is free culture and why free culture is important. And the idea behind the free culture movement is basically that restrictions on culture have an impact, and that works need to be free for the purpose of cultural evolution and access, in the same way that software and all that should be free. And we can talk about that there are those in the free software movement who don't agree or who have a different idea, but that's the idea of the free culture movement. I would say the Creative Commons, you know, putting that in air quotes, community are people that think that work should be freely distributed, but the license that gets used is something that the artist will have a lot more control over. And that's why the term Creative Commons itself is a little bit deceptive. When someone says, oh, I've had this under a Creative Commons license, well, there's no such thing as one Creative Commons license. Creative Commons is a series of licenses, some of which are free culture and some of which are not free culture.
That's true. I'm gonna let you finish, but mm-hmm. I just want to interject that most of the people I know at Creative Commons also have been uncomfortable with the kind of anti-pattern that is sadly common of, you know, oh, this is released under the Creative Commons, or a right. Creative Commons license.
Well, they'll just say this is released under they'll just say under Creative Commons, right? This is released under Creative Commons, and that doesn't actually tell you anything about the terms upon which it can be given or reused. It only says that the creator of the license itself was this organization called Creative Commons. And then you have, and I would say those people are approaching free culture, but they may not agree, or they may not, for whatever reason, want to make their work free culture. They may not be aware of the distinctions. And then you have what I'm going to call remix culture. And that's just people who are using stuff from various sources, and they're not thinking about licenses, and they're not concerned about licenses. And this is another way of putting this might be YouTube culture, right? People that are just taking various clips and putting them together. Maybe they're making new works. Maybe they're putting music on top of something and making a cultural mishmash, or maybe they're making a review or something else, but they're not worried at all about the licensing. They're just mixing and remixing, right? So I know you don't agree with my three groups here. So why don't you jump in, Chris?
Well, I don't agree with the middle one. I don't agree with it because I think that you're identifying a problem there that I agree is true. But so my experience with what I would call the Creative Commons using community, right? The set of people who use the licenses that Creative Commons publish, is that it's a gradient of people, a gradient of understanding of what those are, right? And there have been efforts to try to make it better. You know, the Creative Commons license chooser has tried to help people understand that distinction without, you know, going too much into the detail. And there are some things I even think that Creative Commons has done right about the licensing, but I don't completely agree that it's its own cultural or distinct group. I do agree with the criticism that there are some people using Creative Commons licenses that don't understand those distinctions. But to jump out further, I do agree with a distinction between the strict definition of free cultural works, which there is the free definition, the free cultural works definition, which is pretty much like the free software definition, which also I don't think we've ever actually said what the free software definition is on this show. So very broadly, the idea of the free software definition has these list of four freedoms, which is freedom to run a program, freedom to study how the program works, freedom to redistribute copies, and freedom to redistribute copies of modified versions. So a much simpler version of that, we could say is, you know, the right to
copy, work,
modify, yeah, and distribute.
Right. Well, I would actually say, and to view, right? And this becomes that idea of view, I think, well, I don't know when I jump down this rabbit hole, but jumps into this issue of DRM and file formats and other things like that.
So the free culture definition does pretty much mirror the free software definition, and that's a bit more of a strict definition than the other one. But what's interesting to me is that even kind of from the beginning of kind of this distinct thing of free culture, there was kind of some of the early, you know, kind of minds behind it. Some of them were more interested in what we'd now call remix culture than I think they were interested in kind of the strict definition version of free software. And part of that might...
Who are you thinking about in particular?
I think that maybe he'd say I'm wrong, but I think that Lessig actually is a pretty good example of that. I think that Lessig... I think that the fact that Creative Commons includes two or more, but at least two today, non-free licenses, right? So the Creative Commons does include attribution. It does include attribution share alike. Wait, is it three? I always get confused. So there's basically two clauses that are non-free.
Let's step back. Right. So Creative Commons is a series of licenses. As you say, it's a gradient of licenses in which an artist can choose what terms they want to be in their license. And it's kind of like ordering a coffee at an expensive coffee shop. Right. So you say, well, I want this and I want you to change the milk to soy milk and I want a sprinkle of cinnamon.
Well,
right.
Sort of, because they actually do. They actually do just bake into just a few licenses,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're right. Well,
the choosing process, there's a tool that lets you choose it via those properties.
Right.
And then they kind of, there's this abstract set of core properties. One of them is attribution, which used to be optional and now is just all of the Creative Commons licenses, except for CC0, which
it's not all of them, right?
But basically all of them require attribution. CC0 is for kind of a public domain thing, and that's its own topic. But of the composable components, attribution is just by default in the 3.0 and 4.0 licenses baked in. And the other options that you can select are share alike, which is basically copyleft.
Basically just requiring that if you make a modified version, that you have to give that version under the same terms. So if I take a book that you wrote and maybe I add a chapter, I can't say, oh, well, this is a whole new edition. This isn't Chris's book. This is my book.
Right.
And
so
I have, yeah. And I can't,
yeah,
just
so
lock
it's,
away.
It's copyleft for creative works.
Yeah.
And it's, but it doesn't require source. Before we get into that, let's get to the last two. There's also the non-commercial one, which is said that the work can't be used for commercial purposes, which is very vague. And, you know, the whole topic about what does non-commercial mean is probably an episode of its own. And then there's a no derivatives license or no derivatives clause. And those last two are non-free, right? They don't fit under the free software definition and they don't fit under the free culture definition. But they are provided by Creative Commons.
Right. So I think that gets confusing because there's a lot of websites out there where you can say, oh, I can download, Free Music Archive, for example, which is unfortunately shutting down, but they had a lot of works on there that were not free from a free culture definition standpoint. They were free as in, hey, I can make a copy of this music and give it to you, which is a huge, you know, that's already great. But what I can't do, for example, with a non-commercial license is I can't say, hey, Chris, I made you this remix, or I made you this USB key full of wonderful music. Can you give me $1? Because the USB key cost me $1. right? That's right. A commercial transaction.
And then it also gets, so that seems to be an incentive towards being able to, you know, let's re-license it so that you can pay for that right. But it's very difficult to compose that, because once you have multiple entities remixed into the same non-commercial thing, it actually becomes very hard to figure out who to pay.
And no derivative just means, hey, I can't change the work. It's actually kind of core to this idea of you know, free software and free culture. Of this idea is, hey, the idea is that you can build upon it. Well, a non-derivative work says, well, you can't. You just right. can't build upon this.
So non-commercial, no derivative, non-free. Those
everything
two are
else
non-free.
Is free. Everything
else
is free.
Yeah.
But
I think to continue framing it, mm-hmm. I think part of the reason why, what's interesting is that, I think the free culture community has in general not had as kind of hard, let's say, as hardcore of a base as a free software community has. And in fact, even most free culture and free software people that I know even the ones who are like what we might call free software vegans, and that they don't even run any binary blobs on their computer or anything like that. A lot of them are like, ooh, I like Star Trek or something like that. That's like, you know, from a cultural standpoint, like if we were looking at the same terms, like that's definitely non-free.
Yeah, I would say that's true. But it's also, I mean, two things. One is it's a matter of availability, right? In the sense of, you know, if you live in the world, the modern world, you know, you're exposed to books, you're exposed to music and television and movies, and the vast, vast majority of the works you're going to encounter are going to be non-free. Right. So it's hard to say, well, I don't like anything other than free works. I won't read anything other than free works. That's just not realistic in today's society. I mean, you could make an argument, and I'm not saying this is a perfect analogy, that, you know, you encounter, even if you're a free software vegan, maybe on your own computer, you're not using, non-free software. But of course, you know, if you use, a service on the internet, if you drive a car, you know, you're going to be interacting with proprietary software. But I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. I agree with you that free software people tend to be more, free culture people, sorry, say it differently. Free culture people tend to be more relaxed about the idea of you know, where they're going to borrow their ideas from.
Well, so, I also want to, so what I'm trying to do here is to frame, that there may be a reason for this that's, you've touched on one possible reason, which is that it's harder to be a free culture vegan in some ways, in that, you know, we're immersed in the culture that we walk around with. And you know, it's actually just very software is relatively new, and you have a lot, compared to the amount of time that copyright has existed on cultural words. And it's a much easier base to start being hardcore about it, I guess. But I have to say the other thing is that, despite a lot of the free cultural ideas coming out of the free software movement, leadership in free software early on, one famous leader in particular did not think that free culture was as important.
Right. So of course you're referencing Richard Stallman, who made this interesting distinction that I think many of us in both camps, in both movements, and we should talk about where both of us come from in this world. But Richard Stallman talked about this distinction in his mind between what he called functional works and non-functional works. And so he said that things like software were functional works. They served a purpose. And he said that hardware designs were functional works. And I believe he actually specifically referenced railroad timetables as functional works. And I guess he would also say that maps are functional works, although he didn't explicitly talk about maps. I would say that maps are functional works. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, you might have rock and roll music. Well, rock and roll music, for the most part, doesn't have a function. It doesn't, it only serves to please the listener, to express a feeling, which is an important thing in my mind, a very important thing, but it doesn't have a job, in air quotes, in the same way. I would say that there's plenty of in between things. Textbooks, for example, or any kind of material that's trying to teach is going to have a purpose, but is also going to have some character in it that's going to be conveyed to the student.
So this distinction also gets really weird when you start thinking about the fact that artists are trying to generally make even creative expressions are generally have under the hood some sort of attempt to make a functional impact upon how society works, or at least the most interesting ones do, I think.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think that's the idea behind the free culture movement's, you know, raison d'etre, is that they, and I would put myself in that camp, don't see this distinction between cultural and functional and non-functional works as so clear cut. And even if it was clear cut, even if we say, well, there is such a distinction between, I've got that. I don't know if anyone can hear the siren that's going on in the background. I apologize. But even if people do make that distinction, it's irrelevant, because cultural works can have a major impact on our society. And so they are therefore important, whatever lines you want to draw, they're important. So I do want to take one step back here and say that, you know, Chris, you worked for Creative Commons. You worked for the organization Creative Commons, and I volunteered and was a fellow at Question Copyright. And Question Copyright is absolutely a free culture promoting organization. And Question Copyright, I'm sorry, and Creative Commons, I guess, takes a more nuanced view.
Well, Creative Commons, because of its history, I think, tends to accommodate all ends of what of that kind of spectrum of I guess we'll say kind of hardcoreness about you know, the freeism freedomness of cultural works, right? As an institution, Creative Commons is kind of a steward for the things that it supports, and sometimes and the licenses that it's put together, and sometimes dabbles in that space of the philosophy. But I actually can't speak to the amount that it dabbles anymore now that I don't work there.
Go on.
Well, I mean, so I will say that, you know, that at Creative Commons, so one of the things I did work on was the license chooser, and actually I have not looked at it in some time, but we did take the effort to make sure that when you selected a license from the license chooser, that it would give you the free cultural works definition badge if it was one of the free licenses and not otherwise. And that was like so there was some work to try to bridge
the two worlds,
things in that way. But again, yeah, the institution I tend to think of as largely a steward of the spectrum that the licenses provide, including the non-free side of that spectrum.
So this is going to be an imperfect analogy, but I thought of Creative Commons, the organization, again, not the licenses, but the organization, is kind of like the Sierra Club. You guys were the 800-pound gorilla in the free culture space, right? In the same way that the Sierra Club is this 800-pound gorilla in the environmental space. And we were kind of like friends of the earth. Like, we were the weird radicals. And we didn't just talk about copyright in terms of, well, we want things to be free. We explored what that meant. And so, for example, I know that there were people in QCO, questioncopyright.org. Sorry, I should actually say the organization's name was questioncopyright.org officially. Even though I often just call it Question Copyright. So that believed that we really wanted attribution, and there is no attribution clause in copyright as it is today, not strong attribution. But I believe, for example, I don't want to speak for anyone else, so I'll say I believe that was a cause that many of us, it was like three people, that the organization believed in, even though it was outside of the spectrum of more or less copyright. We believe that copyright needs to be more discussed and needs to be more debated. And I guess it was an organization dedicated to the debate of copyright, although we had a number of projects that were designed to encourage more free work.
Right. So we got into kind of the free culture side of things to some degree. I guess the one thing that we didn't talk about was the public domain, right? So the public domain, it exists both in free software and free culture, and that's basically just a space of things that are not copyrighted.
Right. So copyright in the past expired. It only had a limited time frame. And in fact, that's in the U.S. Constitution required that it be a limited time frame. And so once works are outside of their time, once they sort of expire, they expire into this realm called public domain. And it just means everybody can use it for anything. And they don't have to attribute it. They don't have to license it. It's just, it's available to everyone. And it's honestly, it's where a lot of, if you want to look at, for example, Disney, they make a ton of money on public domain works. A lot of their stories come from things from the 1800s. Their films come from stories from the 1800s, and the works are no longer in copyright, and so they can use them. And public domain is great. I think we both make a distinction between quote unquote true public domain, which is this legal status, and then what Creative Commons or free software people would say public domain, and what they mean is essentially public domain. So,
Want to talk about that? Yeah. So Creative Commons actually has a formal mechanism for this. So what many people also may not realize is that if it's public domain in the U.S., that does not mean it's a public domain everywhere else. Some countries also don't even have a formal concept of a public domain in the way that the U.S. does. And also, interestingly, some things like the U.S. federal government is required to put all of the things that it produces in the U.S. public domain. However, that applies to U.S. citizens, but it doesn't actually necessarily apply internationally. And I believe the U.S. government actually sells, actually uses its copyright overseas and actually sells it, just in a way that does not happen to its own citizens at home. So we can't assume because something's in the public domain here, even though we tend to be kind of loose about it in free software. If somebody says, oh, this is in the public domain, we're kind of like, yeah, whatever. Okay, cool. We'll just pull it in and act as if it's this, no rights reserved type situation. But there is a license that Creative Commons put out. Well, it's so, or we should say a copyright waiver. So CC0 is, basically, tries to put your stuff in the public domain if it can. And if there's no applicable public domain, it has a very lightweight license fallback. And so you can use that. Now, an interesting episode of its own is that sounds really great. I should use this for software. And the story of us trying to get that to happen and, it kind of exploding in our faces, due to an interesting clause in there, but I don't know if that's, something we should get into right now.
Yeah. Let's stick on free culture for now, and we can always revisit. I think these are topics we can go into a lot of depth on in the future. Yeah. Right. So we've talked about, So we've talked about the definitions here, and we've talked a little bit about the differences between, let's say, and again, I know you don't like my distinction, right, between the free culture people and the Creative Commons people. And I know, again, you don't love that distinction.
Let me try to pin down what your distinction is. Mm-hmm. Your distinction is between free culture people and people who consider NC and ND to be acceptable.
Yeah, I would say that it's one of two things. So, I would say that the majority of people who are into free software, for example, and I say into, I mean using and developing, and that would classify themselves as free software developers. I'm going to talk specifically about software. we'll look at a piece of software and consider its license as a feature. So if I see a piece of software that looks really good and I see that it's GPL'd, I'm like, yeah, that's even better now that it's GPL'd. And there's a subset of software developers who are producing free software who don't look at it that way. They're just like, whatever, get me a license that works. And so they might use the MIT license, or they might use the Apache license or something like that, because they're not subscribing necessarily to the ideology of the free software movement. And I think that there are a lot of artists out there who will produce some work, and then they will go to the license chooser on the Creative Commons website, and they will read something that says no commercial use. And the image in their mind is that someone is going to make a CD. I'm going to pretend they're a musician, right? So somebody's going to make a CD or put it on iTunes. There's going to be billions of downloads, and they're not going to see a penny. And so in that moment, they feel exploited, right? They go, why can't I get some piece of that pie, right? Yeah. And then they feel cheated, and they click, I don't want any commercial use. Or right. I want to get to the ND part a little bit. And I think that there's a similar idea of some of non-derivatives, right? This non-derivative idea. And they'll say, well, wait, does that mean somebody could just change some of my words and then claim it's theirs? Right. And so, but they still want to do something. They want to make it better. They want to make it so that you and I can give each other their music, but they're not subscribed to their whole ideology. And I think that's the distinction. It's not so much that they believe that that ND and NC are good, so much as that they're not subscribing to the whole ideology, and they're not sitting around thinking about it like we do.
Right. So I kind of think of that as Remix Culture Volume 1, and then there's a Remix Culture Volume 2, which is what YouTube has kind of enabled in some ways, or in not in necessarily a positive way in my definition of enabled. But we'll get to that in a second. But I think I do agree with you. And so I think you're also kind of lobbing a slight criticism towards the Creative Commons license chooser, which I would agree with, actually, which is that the fact that you may or may not get a badge after the fact that says that this is a free cultural work is not guiding users enough, because they might select that non-commercial and no derivative stuff and not really understand the consequences of how it affects the commons.
Yeah, or even what commercial use is. So I have encountered people who, you know, they are totally okay with, you know, for example, a nonprofit, you know, selling CDs and just making a little bit of money. They're for a lot of them, it's about scale, and it's about feeling exploited. And there are other
mechanisms. Or not just selling CDs, that, like, maybe we should say, you know, maybe the nonprofit has a podcast and they put the music at the front of the episode.
Yeah, that's right. So for example, in our podcast, we don't use any non-commercial music, even though there's some great stuff out there, because
we did donate to the artist.
But we don't put anything on this podcast because there is a possibility that we, for example, and we don't, I don't think we do this now, but if, for example, we decided to have an advertisement, on the website and we use the NC license, it's my understanding that that would then be a commercial work on our part, and we would be in a tricky situation. I won't say we'll be violating. I'll say it's a tricky situation.
I was just, by the way, my interjection there may have been confusing. I was just saying, you know, that, I mean, kind of in support of, just because there's not a non-commercial thing on the thing that we chose doesn't mean that we're not willing to support the artist. But I mean, you could also say, so it gets even fuzzier than that, right? We have the, you know, you can donate to my Patreon thing at the end of the episode. Does that make this a commercial podcast, right?
Oh, good question. Right. That's an excellent question.
So, like, it's not just whether or not we put an advertisement in there. Like, that feels a little bit more direct to me, right? It's even something like, are you willing to donate, right? And And it's, and there is a Creative Commons. So Creative Commons did do a survey, since this is such a tricky issue. I guess I should find it and link it so that it can be in the show notes. But Creative Commons did do a survey of what people's understanding of non-commercial was. And that helped give some sense of kind of the spectrum of things that people understood. But people do not necessarily understand things the same way, right? The discussion about, does a nonprofit putting something in their end of the year donation drive thing count as non-commercial or not versus a corporation doing it, is kind of unclear. Or, you know, even, you know, like, or anything along those lines, right? Like, what about the nonprofit actually just using it as a photo that they put up on their website? If the Wall Street Journal did it, then you'd probably be like, that's commercial use. But if there was just a blog post where, you know, that the nonprofit was using, is that commercial use? Well, it's unclear, right? And there is no strict, and the Creative Commons licenses specifically, or the Creative Commons licenses using NC specifically do not flesh that out for you. And so that's a space that I think people do not realize how complicated it is.
So do we want to, so here's a little fork in the road. Do we want to talk about, this, what you call Remix Culture Volume 2? Or do we want to talk about something that QCO talk did to try to address this commercial, non-commercial distinction problem?
I'm happy to hear. I don't have a strong preference, so you
all
go
right, so
which
let's,
direction.
So let's stick on to this and talk a little bit about QCO's idea, which I would say I don't think it really was a hugely successful project, but it was a really neat idea. So QCO's position was that the purpose of most donations, the purpose of most purchases of an artist's work was to support the artist. That the reason that I buy a CD or go to Amazon or iTunes to download some music is that I want to support the artist. And it's not that I couldn't get the music for free, but because I probably can.
Right.
And so therefore, the thing that we should be optimizing for is supporting the artist and not all this other stuff. Now, we don't need copyright to support the artist. And I would say that Patreon actually, which didn't exist when the project I'm about to mention is launched, has actually helped with that. It's separated out paying an artist for the stuff that they create. But the idea that QCO had was something that they called the creator mark. And the creator mark was this image that you could put on a physical medium or a website, and it would say Creative Mark 40 or Creative Mark 25. And what that number represented was that was the percentage of revenue that would come in and then be given to the artist. So if you can imagine, I sell a CD, or you're talking about CDs a lot here, but I sell a CD or a download for a dollar. Well, 25 cents of that dollar will go directly to the artist. And maybe it'll be 90%, maybe it'll be 100%. And they also had a generic mark that would just be some percentage would go. And then the idea was that the artist would, on their social media, say, hey, you should get it from the one that gives me the highest percentage, right? You should give it to me. You should go and get this from the guy or gal or whoever that gives me 90% rather than the guy who gives me 25% or maybe the organization that gives me nothing. So that was the idea of the creator mark. And then they put that mark in trademark so that you had to be sort of certified to use it. And again, the project didn't take off, but it was a really neat idea for a way of around this problem of what is a, you know, how do we support this artist without needing to feed into the idea of monopoly and restriction, which is the core of copyright. The idea of copyright is that only certain people can produce the work and distribute that work.
And in some sense, that's kind of a counterpoint to the anxiety that you were describing that people hit, where they might choose NC in that moment because they feel they're worried about being ripped off.
Right, exactly. It was created specifically to allow artists to have that connection with their fans, and for fans to know what to look for. So if I'm buying something that's related to an artist's work, I'm going to buy the thing with the highest creator mark, right? Because it's almost like a mark of purity when I'm buying a product, right? I'm going to go, oh, well, this one is better than that one because the number is higher. And it kind of reminds me in the non-free space of Humble Bundle, which is a website.
Well, actually, that was originally originally free software released in the Humble Bundle, and then they dropped that.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. All right. So Humble Bundle is a website where you can download, various types of content. So books and video games and things. And many times you can name the price that you want to pay. And then you can also, I think in some cases, adjust how much overhead they take versus the artist. So how much Humble Bundle itself gets versus the creator of the work getting. So it was kind of like that, but instead of, so the problem with Humble Bundle and is, well, A, they support non-free things, and whereas the creative mark would only be used for free culture works, I believe. I might be wrong, but I believe that's the case. And with Humble Bundle, you can only do it through Humble Bundle. The idea here was that if I had this creator mark, I could go to any vendor, right? Whether it be a big online retailer or a store, I would know what to look for. It would be something on the website or on the package that I could look for. And if someone violated that, they could be sued, right? Because it's a trademarked image. You can't just use it.
Mm-hmm. I think a thing that you're highlighting here is, so I'm going to bring up another proprietary service that I don't use, but many of my friends do. And actually bring it up in the context of, so another thing that, in this category, and a very interesting overlap of category, interesting in many regards between free software and free culture is video games, because they both require culture, and software in order to work, right? For a long time, actually, Richard Stallman, I think, took the position that video games in general were really just not something to worry about, too much about as in terms of proprietary software. I don't have a link to back this up, but I'm pretty sure, he pretty much was just very hand wavy at that time. Like, well, you know, even the software was like not really that big of a deal. So I don't know how he's going to feel about me kind of quoting this exchange on here, but I had an exchange with Bradley Kuhn, who at one point also, you know, took a position about, well, games really don't matter that much, and agreed with RMS that, you know, they're not really a functional work. It's not a big deal, blah, blah, blah. He changed his mind partly because we had a conversation where I said, Steam, which is a proprietary game delivery service that uses DRM. And at that time, Steam was not available on GNU Linux. And I said, Steam is the way that DRM will come to GNU Linux, and the users will rejoice about the arrival of DRM. And I think that changed his mind. And that turned out to be true. Like, a lot of people are like, Steam does DRM right, right? And you hear that people say the same thing about Netflix. And one of the things that strikes me about that is, A, it's very upsetting to hear people say, you know, doing DRM right. But it does tie in. Most of the people that I know who do use Steam would be happy to pay for things if it was free and open source software. And in fact, the DRM is not an inhibitor for them. They are people who could very well download things from a peer-to-peer service, what the proprietary software community might call pirated version of the software, right? They are perfectly capable of doing that. But the reason that they're paying for it is not out of legal fear or an inability to do it, but because they think, oh, well, this is a great way to be able to pay for games so that games can keep coming down the pipeline for me.
Right. And when you say pay for, what you really mean is it's a means of funding the creation of it's a means of supporting the artist. And when I say artist, it doesn't necessarily mean a single artist. It could mean a game studio, right? But
right.
But it means funding them for the work that they've put into it and funding their future work.
Right. And so this thing about users celebrating the arrival of DRM on GNU Linux also speaks to another thing to me about how free software and free culture are deeply interrelated, which is that most of the places where free software has really been kind of screwed over and over again has to do with things that the media industry is doing, right? Like, whether it's patents on MP3s or it's DRM on watching video and audio, and all sorts of things like that. Or, even the proprietary drivers for that are required to play many 3D games, almost always when it's a point, with one exception being also the phone industry, being the other place where we tend to have a lot of trouble. In general, it actually ends up being the places where what RMS might call non-functional works actually interact with our software.
Yeah, so I don't have much to say. I agree with you. I think that we in the free software and free culture community kind of missed the boat here. We assumed that the proprietary world would act in a certain way, which is that they would continue to do what they were doing, and what they were doing in the 90s and 2000s were just cracking down, right? So I remember hearing stories about, this grandmother was sued by I believe it was the Recording Industry of America for some unstated amount of money because her grandchild had downloaded some music or something. And what they did instead was to start fixing the bugs in their software and make it feel they did two things. So they fixed the bugs in the software. So when it broke, it wasn't as intrusive. And then they went ahead and normalized it culturally. So, and you give the example of Netflix, right? So streaming services are interesting because it has changed our idea of what having a video library is. I remember, people would have lots of movies and they'd have them on VHS or if they were maybe Laserdisc and then DVD. And now people don't have those because they're actually less convenient than just going to a button and pressing a button and renting a movie or having it on a streaming service. So I agree. And I think what we as a community need to do as a free software and free culture community is to start looking at the features that these companies have provided and make something equivalent. And we did that, when we look at things like, Debian and the program apt-get, right? And then you think about something like Steam or iTunes, the iTunes marketplace or the Apple market, or whatever it's called. I think they call it the store and then the Android marketplace or whatever they're called, right? But we started that. And one of the things that they do really well is synchronization, right? So if you've got programs on one system, on one phone, it synchronizes to all your phones. Or if you've got music that you've downloaded on one platform, it synchronizes to all the platforms. And we've not been keeping up with them, and we haven't with these programs, and we haven't been keeping up with the cultural changes in the same way. And that's on us as a community.
Oh, well, another thing. And so this comes to both free software and free culture. So I agree with you that like the rise of, streaming services and app stores was preceded by package managers in the free software space in many ways. I agree with that. But another thing that they do well that we don't do well is making it easy to compensate, developers and artists, right? Nobody in the free. So despite the English confusion over the term free, anybody you talk to who is a, you know, free as in Libre, although that acronym ends up as fail, so let's not use that. You know, who is free as in freedom type person will say, well, actually, I'm A-okay with, distributing, free software, and, you know, and for, by paying for it, or even just, you know, voluntarily paying for it. But we don't make it easy to do that, right? Our, even our app store, our equivalent of app stores today are not really built in such a way that encourage compensation. And I guess part of that might be that once you end up involving money, sometimes it can actually make things a little bit complicated, for your community, deciding who gets that money and stuff like that. But I mean, I think part of it is just that we haven't really prioritized that type of thing. And when we don't prioritize that type of thing, it means somebody else ends up getting it. I mean, so to, so one thing, one way that this became very clear to me was that, about a decade ago, before Steam got really huge, when it was just starting out, I ran a, very unsuccessful Blender user group in Chicago. It met for a total of one meeting. And in that one meeting, another Blender developer I knew and somebody I didn't know showed up. And what they mostly talked about was they were both game developers, and they mostly talked about, hey, we're indie game developers, and finally, we have a way to be able to make money, and it's all thanks to this proprietary company that's distributing things via Steam. And everyone I had talked to at that moment, because I guess I'm so insular, had been people who had felt as if independent people had felt abhorrent towards the ideas of proprietary distribution services. And I kind of felt that way being in the free software and free culture community, where it felt very indie to be against those type of things. And then I realized that that wasn't necessarily the case for these people, two people I was sitting down with. And I don't know that, I mean, I kind of feel like that starts to bleed into the Remix Culture 2.0, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think we have done a poor job of reaching out and explaining. I think this is a lot also about entrepreneurship, and we haven't offered a lot of these people a path to be paid, and so they've had to go another way. I think a lot of these people are, if you ask them, they would say, "Well, I'm an open source supporter," and you go, "Well, that's great," and they go, "Well, but not their own work." Right. Or they might contribute if they're really good guys. And I say guys could be gals or non-binary or whatever. But if they're really good people, they might say, well, I did write this library that's tangential, or it's used in my program. But I'm not going to release the whole thing. I'm going to release a piece that's not critical to my program. But I do think we should talk a little bit about Remix Culture. Because it's an important part of this narrative. And then maybe if our audience wants to, you know, comment, and we can go in a deeper dive later. Right. So, right. So what I'm going to call Remix Culture, and I don't love the idea of calling it YouTube culture, because it's not just YouTube, but YouTube has become synonymous with this in kind of the same way that,
well, and it preceded YouTube, but YouTube has changed the space to some degree.
Right. Yeah.
So I'd count the, like, the participatory, not the participatory, the open movie, like, or maybe it was participatory video, like the open movie movement was kind of in the same category, where it was more about access to being able to produce movies than it was actually that much concern about their licensing and things like that.
Fair enough.
And their ability to share it and remix it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's talk about what it is. Let's define it, at least for ourselves. So you have people who are just making combinations of work. So it might just be something as simple as you take one movie or, you know, one TV show and put music behind it. That's something else. Or maybe it's a whole movie and you put music behind it. Or maybe they're combining works and making something completely new, or, you know, putting, stringing clips together. And that's always been part of culture, right? That's always been part of our cultural heritage. And that's the idea in free culture. But they're not concerned with the licensing in this remix culture. People are just doing the stuff. And as far as they're concerned, they're quote unquote getting away with it. And there was a period of time, and this is, I think, what's going to come where we're talking about YouTube specifically and why you think YouTube is so important in this movement is, for a long time, YouTubers would get shut down. So, hey, you're using this music. Well, this company claims to own this music, so we're taking this away.
And that did lead to, like, user outrage.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And including, by the way, I should mention, including question copyright. Where we made our own videos and they had notices from of music violations by various parties. And when that would happen, YouTube had this procedure where we'd have to argue that they were wrong, and it was a very opaque process. And I don't even remember what ended up happening, because we produced our own music for our videos, and yet there was no way to stop the copyright claims over our work. But what, and this copyright claims thing is important, because in the beginning it was, well, if a claim is put on your work, they'll shut it down and then it'll just be off and it'll be gone. But then YouTube had this very smart idea, which was that they said, well, no, we won't have to shut it down. We'll just automatically monetize it. And what they mean is, we'll put ads around it, or before it and after it and around it. And then we will give part of the revenue to the entity that claims copyright over the work. So if you put music behind your home movies, you can keep the video, but at least in the ideal world, the music company would get some amount of money every time someone watches your video.
And in many cases, also as an additional carrot towards, you know, this scenario, the person producing the remix version might get paid as well.
Yeah. So it's kind of this idea of, well, everyone's getting paid, everyone's getting money. So let's everyone be happy. And in some ways, it's not a terrible compromise if it works perfectly. Right. So if it works perfectly, then you could say, well, okay, I'm getting to keep my creative expression up. If I'm a content producer, I'm getting to keep my creative expression up. I don't have to take it down. Some percentage is going to be taken from me, but that's okay, because that saves me the work of having to license the music myself, which may be either impossible or just impractical, because the procedure for licensing music is cumbersome. So YouTube is sort of taking care of all that for me. But what it has done is it has two problems. So the first is that it doesn't work. And as I just mentioned, Creative Commons, questioncopyright.org, would get these notices, and we would get these notices, not infrequently. And we would
Blender Institute had it happen recently as well, which actually pushed them to experimenting with PeerTube, which is a federated and peer-to-peer delivery alternative to YouTube.
Yeah, so it doesn't work. Or it doesn't work perfectly. And that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that by sort of washing all this away with, well, we're all getting paid, you ignore the core issue of license and the copyright. You know, you basically make, you obfuscate the problem by just throwing money around. And
well, you throw away, you say, it's, you know, instead of worrying about user freedom, we're going to create a walled garden with some rules that everybody can play inside of that walled garden, which means also you can never leave the walled garden.
That's right. So that's an important thing here. So if I have a music, if I've got some video with some music behind it, I can have it on YouTube. But if I take that video off of YouTube and put it and I host it on my own website, well, that's not going to work. That means that I'm leaving the YouTube, as you call it, walled garden, and now I'm subject to takedown and all the same problems. And what that does is just incentivize people to stay on YouTube out of fear or practical fear, let's call it, right? That you can't leave, because if you did, you'd be shut down or sued.
Right. So we've highly centralized our culture. We found a new gatekeeper for it, though.
Yeah, and it's friendlier than the previous gatekeepers, because the previous gatekeepers would just shut it down. So YouTube has negotiated this alternative, and in some ways, it can feel very free. It feels like you're not being encumbered by the process, but in fact, you are.
Right. So I think that in maybe what we're getting to is that free culture advocates were somewhat blindsided by how suave the proprietary world got about the tactics that they took.
Well, what they did was they took our tactics and our ideas and our ideas about communicating with the artist. They took our ideas about separating out payment. They took our ideas about they took our idea about wanting to be able to remix and create new works, and they found ways of culturally separating out that from the payment system. So it was invisible to most people, but it's not invisible to YouTube creators or people that really make their living. They are very well aware of these problems. And YouTube in particular also has a catalog of music that's YouTube safe music. They encourage their creators to use, but you can't leave YouTube, right? It can't leave YouTube. You can't take that same music and put it on another video service.
Right. And what happens if YouTube goes down some way a day? Do we lose all of our cultural heritage that was stored on YouTube?
Well, that's a great question. And it reminds me of a Jason Scott talk that is about this and the website GeoCities, which at one time was a huge part of the web and is now gone. And that's right. When we have these central sites, they will eventually go away. And with that,
why host your own blog? You can just post it on Medium. You know, it'll survive just the same way GeoCities did.
Right. Or I remember, I mean, people are talking about Facebook and Twitter, and we now have an alternative. I remember LiveJournal. And LiveJournal was already an improvement over other site systems at the time, because you could technically run your own LiveJournal instance, although most people didn't do that. But yeah, we have gone through this many times, and I think self-hosting is where the free software community needs to start putting some of its focus. I think that and mobile and what I'm going to call not just mobile computing in the sense of phones, but what I talked about earlier about synchronizing your information across devices, self-hosting and again, I wish I had a better term for it, but this idea of synchronizing, those are the two areas where I feel that we as a community need to start putting our focus, or we are just going to lose completely.
And making it easy, right? Like, because it's not easy to self-host stuff right now.
No,
it's a lot of work.
It is, and there are projects that do make it easier. But
which we will probably cover in future episodes.
We absolutely should. But they're not perfect. None of them are currently something that I could recommend to a non-technical friend. I couldn't just say, "Hey, right, go ahead and do this turnkey solution." And I'll tell you that I even have friends who they wouldn't even do it if they could, because the proprietary guys have sold them on advantages. Like, oh, well, we've got the cloud and backups and all this other stuff. But we're moving away from free culture. We should stick on free culture.
I have something that I do want to cover before we wrap up this episode.
Okay.
Actually, I have two points. Let me, and they're both kind of Well, they may or may not be related. I'm going to throw them both out there and then let you choose which one you think is more important to cover first. So one of them is, why aren't there enough high quality free cultural projects? Like, we see a lot of high quality free software projects that in general, the world, I think, recognizes that there's a lot of high quality free software in that almost everybody uses free software every day, whether they realize it or not. But that's not the case with free culture, with certain exceptions like Wikipedia. And the second question is, and it may or may not be related, I'll be interested to hear if you think it is, why don't we see free culture developed in a distributed fashion the way that we see happen with free software?
So that's, boy, we're going to go a little bit meta. Do you consider Wikipedia culture? Or do you consider it a functional?
Well, that's an interesting question. So, like, it is culture, but it's kind of more of a data e-culture than a creative e-culture, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it lends itself well to collaboration in the same way that software lends itself well to collaboration. There's an objective. There's some objective data. There's editing that can be done that's about style.
It's in plain text, and it uses tools that look like free software tools, right?
And not only
you've got diffs. Yeah.
I also don't know how connected you are with the Wikipedia culture. I was at one time somewhat on the periphery because of my involvement with OpenStreetMap and also because I was hanging out with the Wikipedia guys in New York. So I had some exposure, and I don't know how much that applies to you.
I don't have as much as I should, but we know people who do. So we know Evan Prodromo, who actually did tons of federated social web stuff, and he's now working at the Wikimedia Foundation. And so we should probably have him on. And Greg Grossmeyer, likewise, also a free culture person who works at the Wikimedia Foundation. We should probably have on some of those people to talk about these things on a future episode.
Yeah, and I mean, we could also have people from my days in OpenStreetMap, and some of those people also work at Wikimedia. So, I don't think of Wikipedia as a free culture work.
It's not creatively free culture.
No, it's not. When I think about free culture, I'm thinking about books and music and movies, right? Those are the big three, I guess, and video games. But we've talked a little bit about video game
assets at least, we should
have a separate episode about that. So let's talk about books, and let's talk about music, because those are the ones we're going to find the most of. There aren't very many fully free films.
Well, some of our best examples in this space actually come from the Blender community.
But they're not full-length films.
They're not, but they are solid quality works.
Yeah, I hear you and I agree with you, but I think we're picking nits a little bit, but when I think about a movie, I'm not talking about a 5-minute short. I'm thinking about a full-length feature film.
Okay. I think there's good reasons to take a lot of lessons from that space, but why don't we make that argument as we go?
Okay. So let's start with books. I think books are the best because they require only one person to write. You only need one person to write a book. And so I'm talking about a fiction book. So you don't have a lot of fiction that is free culture.
Do on some of these independent publisher sites.
That's free culture. So we're not talking about NC, right? So none of Cory Doctorow's work. And I'm, by the way, I like Cory Doctorow's books. And I, you know, would love to be able to promote him as a free culture artist. I do not agree with him that his works are free.
I could be wrong. I should double check. I think Smashwords may have quite a bit, but I could actually be wrong. I haven't actually looked at it in detail. So I should shut up.
So we should, you know, I will tell you, we've talked about this outside the podcast. I started a project a couple of years ago, and the idea was that I wanted to make a repository of free works, only free works. So no stuff with NC or ND. And it was going to be a website with a piece of software that was going to work a lot like an app store or a web store. And you'd be able to say, oh, this is a piece of music I like, and this is a book I like, and I'm going to download this to this device. And then when you would go on to your next device, you would sign in, and it would say, oh, here are the things you liked on this other one, and it would just kind of sync it up for you in the background, and you wouldn't have to think about it. And I thought, won't this be clever? And it'll be just like the big proprietary guys. It'll just be like iTunes and Amazon, but it'll be totally free, and everyone will start wanting to put their stuff on this. All I need is a good seed amount of, you know, of good cultural works, and then that will just spur everything. And outside of Project Gutenberg, which has public domain works, which is awesome, right?
Yeah.
But I was looking for new works that were of high quality and were free culture, and I found a lot of technical manuals and textbooks, which are great, but I was looking for fiction, and I just didn't find very much. And maybe I was looking in the wrong spots, and I was also looking for music, and I didn't find very much.
I mean, yeah. So I think you're right that there's not nearly as much. You're definitely right that there's not nearly as much as we'd like, and I think music has more than
literature
books do.
Yeah,
than literature, and I think definitely more music that's free, that's of high quality than video.
And I didn't find a lot. Again, maybe I wasn't searching hard enough, but everything. With one exception. So a band that I love is Lorenzo's Music, and their stuff is totally free. And I found a lot of stuff that was kind of garage band, you know, I'm going to make some electronic music on my computer, and it was cute, but it wasn't especially great or creative or new. It wasn't stuff that I would want to curate on a site. And I kept looking, and I went into the Free Music Archive, and I went on to Creative Commons and CC Mixer and Jamendo and others, but they were all NC, or they were all non-commercial use, at least not all, but for a vast majority were non-commercial, and some were non-derivatives. And I just went, oh, this is pretty terrible. And I ended up not continuing with the project simply because I just didn't have the resources to keep scouring the internet, and I didn't feel like I felt like I needed at least 100 albums or 100 books to start.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But would you agree that we don't feel the same issue is the case in software?
No, software. We have tons, thousands of programs. It's wonderful. It's amazing.
I mean, in that sense, it's kind of weird. Stallman's distinction does hold up as in terms of what ended up being successful, if not as in terms of principles. Like, I don't agree with it in principles, but when it comes to, like, and you could say Wikipedia is very successful, but it is a functional work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it turns out that's the area where Stallman was right. Was not actually what he said about it being important. I actually think that it is very important in the cultural space, but in the categories that he gave turn out to be true in terms of success.
Yeah, and I would say that is at least as true because of our failure as a community thus far to provide alternative means of funding. Rather than some kind of intrinsic aspect of the work itself. What I mean by that is many people who are doing free software are doing it, and they are paid either directly now for writing free software, or they are indirectly subsidizing their free software because it's related to some work that they're doing, and they're writing a library because it's solving a problem, and maybe they're game developers, as you say, and right, so they're contributing to Blender because it will help them produce an asset that they need for a project. And that's great, but we don't have mechanisms like that. The only thing we have is the grant process for artists, and, you know, government or nonprofit grants. And thus far, those grants have not required that the works be free. And if that changed,
which is funny, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree. Like, it should be, hey, the taxpayers are paying for this, therefore the work must be free.
Yeah. I think you were somewhat dismissive of the, so this is kind of changing topics, and I agree with everything you just said, but, getting into the how this stuff is developed, I actually do want to highlight. So, you know, if you look at the Blender Open Movie stuff, I think there's some interesting stuff to look at about that. Is that it's actually an interesting example of a free software project being driven by free culture, right? So the Blender projects tend to actually get features in accordance to what the movies that are being produced need. B, the Blender Open Movie projects are actually massively successful, in terms of getting a viewership, right? So they might not be full feature length movies, but lots of people watch them, like in the millions. Mm-hmm. And that's not true of many other free culture works. So that's certainly notable, it feels to me. In C, you do get the source code, which, as we mentioned earlier, even the copyleft of free culture and the Creative Commons, you know, attribution share alike does not require source code, but, and it's done in a very throw code over the wall style development where the source code comes out after the movie's been produced. But in the Blender Open Movie projects, they have released the source code in the sense of the Blender files and the GIMP files and the Krita files and stuff like that to produce the movie. They release them in the same way that you can study, use, modify, and even compile the movie yourself.
So here's my question to you as someone who is clearly into that community. How often are those assets used in the way you're describing?
Not enough. They are, I think, studied more than they are reused. Though they are reused sometimes. So I do see the assets reused sometimes, but what's kind of disappointing in some ways is that the most common way that you see the Blender Open Movie stuff getting reused is companies showing them in their product ads because they legally can. I do find that to be kind of a bit of a bummer that we haven't seen the reuse of that source code. Now, I have learned a lot by opening and modifying those files, actually. A lot of my Blender skills came from investigating and studying those things. But I'll admit, you don't see much stuff produced after the fact. There is some, but it's very small, of stuff that's reusing the assets from those.
Because my question really is, it's not a sort of admonishment of the reuse as much as it is that, coming back to the top of the show, when we talked about the distinction between in the licenses that are for software that require source code and the licenses for culture that do not, we mentioned that the GPL v3 talks about, I can't remember the exact term, but I think it was something along the lines of preferred format, right? Is that, or preferred something?
Yeah, preferred form
preferred
for
form
modification.
For modification, right? Thank you. Well, if the works that are not, if the works are not being used in that way, meaning if people are not taking the Blender source files of the objects, the assets, and reusing them directly, then I wonder if the preferred form is that source code in the cultural space.
I don't know. I do know that a lot of that ever since Blender moved to the Blender Cloud thing, that the which is the way that they're funding things today, the Blender Institute, that it does seem like there's a lot of assets that are uploaded to there that people are copying and reusing for their own work.
So it's kind of like the Unity assets engine where you can just download.
Yeah. So it's kind of, so it's seeing success there and being kind of an asset repository. But what I'm not seeing success in, so this is kind of where I wanted to get to. And this actually, by the way, and probably we should do a whole episode about Liberated Pixel Cup, but this was actually the thesis behind Liberated Pixel Cup, which was the project that I kind of got away with doing when I was tech lead in the last year I was at Creative Commons, which was kind of a big experiment about the interaction of free software and free culture. And the thesis there was we don't see much as in terms of free culture that is kind of built in the way that we see free software built in a distributed way. And we don't see it being reused as much. Now, there is a site called Open Game Art that we work with to do Liberated Pixel Cup, and they had a lot of assets on there. But what you would notice is that a lot of those assets were incompatible with each other stylistically. So if you tried to make a game using a bunch of them, what you'd end up with was this incompatible kind of mosaic.
But visually incompatible Open Game Art.
Visually incompatible assets that look like kind of like you cut and pasted them out of a newspaper, like a bunch of pictures out of there. And like it really did not look very appealing to do that. So what Liberated Pixel Cup did was we hired some artists, and it was a So it was Creative Commons, the Free Software Foundation, and Mozilla that worked on this. And we raised some money to pay some artists. The artists created some initial assets in the style guide. And then we also ran two contests, one to extend this to make new assets using that style guide, and then a contest to use to make games that were free software games using those assets. It was very successful in terms of number of entries. We got 50 in each category, about 100 games and contributions each, which was beyond what we expected or were prepared to judge. But what's more interesting to me is that people are still making assets today, about 6 years later, that are still compatible with the look and feel of the stuff that we laid out. And it's mainly because of that style guide, which was influenced by the Tango icon style guide, by the way.
So would you say that this is similar to, and I don't know the answer to this, but when I think about a community of remixers, I think about the game modding community, which is a large group that we don't really interact much with. Right, but people that are modding games and putting new art and new skins and all of that.
So they already have a reference of how the things should look, right? Which is the original game, right? And what Liberated Pixel Cup did was that it created another reference for this thing that said, okay, here's the initial assets, and we also even specified here's how you actually make your art look like it's gonna fit, right? And so in the modding communities, they actually also have a reference, which is just all the stuff that was released from the original thing, right? And so I think it is similar in that regard. I'm actually surprised that we're still seeing things like that as coming out for today. And in that sense, I see it to be a big success. There's other ways in which I'd say it's not a success, and I'll reserve that for a future episode.
Well, then let me ask you one question. We should probably start wrapping up, but as someone who's working on Sprightly, which we should talk about it in some future episode, which I know we will because it's a huge part of your life, which is a game. But my understanding is it's going to be text-based, at least what you produce, right?
The initial version will be text-based, but you may be hinting at, like, why wouldn't I use something like that, right?
Well, no. My question is, are you going to put out a style guide for people that want to produce software against your system? style guide of what?
Oh, that's interesting. So, maybe, you know, quite possibly. Let's not get into that into detail, and instead I'll pivot to saying, what's interesting though is that we actually, that's a thing that we do for source code, is that we have style guides, which, you know, the free culture community generally doesn't when working on software, right? And the way the Blender community got around it for the Blender Open Movie project is they have, a lead artist who's running a specific project, right? But if you want to have a more distributed thing that doesn't have this lead artist kind of watching over the thing, then you need a style guide. And source code, we both have style guides that get written up, and also we have the conventions of our code that constrain it so that, you know what the indentation shape is going to look like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of the effort that ends up happening on code review and free software projects is making sure that code meshes with the rest of the project. And one question I have is, why don't we see massively distributed free culture projects that have that same level of attention to
coherence? I guess I question this thesis. So here's what I mean. If we look at the largest free software projects, you are right that they have many contributors. So if we look at something like LibreOffice, lots of contributors. But there's a majority of free software that has a very small number of contributors.
That's true.
And so you're now comparing a very large set so with free culture, as we've talked about, there's very few pieces of free culture. Right. There's, mm-hmm. I'm going to make up a number. Let's say there's 1,000 pieces of free culture, literary works. I'm just making up this number. Right. But we have thousands and thousands of free software projects, and only a few of them have lots of contributors working in a distributed fashion. Most of them have maybe 3 or 4 contributors, or maybe even one.
Sure.
So we can't really do a comparison right now because the numbers are so different, and maybe statistically they're actually the same.
Yeah, well, so
our sample size is too small.
I agree that the sample sizes are very small, and I think partly what you're saying is maybe these patterns would come out if we were taking free culture more seriously in the first place.
If we had a lot more free culture, or if free culture had the same economic incentives as free software. And, you know, I'm really lazy. I have a draft in one of my folders in my computer where I say, I wanted to write about funding of free software and how I think funding of free software is broken in our community. But this discussion is making me think that the funding of free culture is totally broken, right?
So, it's more broken than
it
free
is more
software.
Broken than free software. Grants that go to artists should require that the work be under a free license. And I think if we saw that, then what would happen is that the projects that would have these artistic. So first of all, literature doesn't really usually require very, very many contributors, right? You have your writer and you have an editor. And maybe two editors, right? That's usually all you need, and maybe a formatter. But you don't need that many people to write a literary work of fiction. A piece of music, you might have an artist or two. You're going to need someone to edit it. Could be the same person. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's someone else to produce it, right? So you do you're going to see more of that when you're talking about a film. You need yet more people, right? Now you need, especially if it's because we've only talked about live action. Sorry, we've talked about animated things with Blender, but there could also be live action. So now you have actors, you have a director, you have a producer, You have a lot more that will go into a film. And so you have a lot more people by necessity. In terms of being distributed, that's an interesting question. But just in terms of the mediums themselves, you tend to have less people for the kinds of things that we have, free culture for right now.
Right. Yeah. So let's put it this way. You and I both might agree that free culture, as in like the more serious definition of free culture, as in terms of like abiding by principles definition of free culture, still doesn't have enough serious works behind it. And maybe we could see if we could figure out, in the process of figuring out how to make that happen, we might be able to figure out a lot of these other things.
I think with that, let's wrap it up. And thank our audience for being here. And yeah, we'll see you guys next time. Bye.
Yep. Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on opengameart.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.